is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I want guys to get used to playing and competing. And in terms of like just the big picture, the biggest thing we're trying to get out of a practice, more than even defense or offense, is we want to teach our guys how to compete. We want to make sure our guys come out of every practice understanding what it's like to play hard, because that's the standard it takes to win a championship.
Shiva Sentel just completed his first season as the head men's basketball coach at Oberlin College in the state of Ohio. Sentel came to Oberlin after a successful 3-year tenure as the head coach at SUNY Canton in Canton, New York. In 2020, Shiva was one of just 30 honorees nationally across all divisions to be named to the 2019-2020 Under Armour National Association of Basketball Coaches 30 Under 30 team. Prior to his arrival at SUNY Canton, Sentel spent the 2018-2019 season as an assistant coach at the University of Chicago. He has additional coaching stops as an assistant at Clarkson University, SUNY Purchase, and Michigan Dearborn. As a player, Sentel helped Hartwick College reach the NCAA tournament 2 times in 2011 and 2012, and in 2014, he served as a student assistant coach at Hartwick as well. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hey, this is Byron Burt, head boys basketball coach at St. Lawrence High School in Burbank, Illinois, and you're listening to Hoopheads Podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Take some notes as you listen to this episode with Shiva Sentel, head men's basketball coach at Oberlin College in the state of Ohio. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinsing here, without my co-host, Jason Sunkel, who is with his 4 kids and his wife on his way to Disney World in Florida. God bless him. He's going and taking 4 kids under the age of 8. So he claims it's a vacation. I'm not quite sure if that's the case. But we are pleased to welcome Shiva Sentel, the head men's basketball coach at Oberlin College here in the state of Ohio. Shiva, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thanks for having me, Mike. I'm excited. This should be a lot of fun.
Thrilled to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do in your career thus far. Let's go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Yeah, so it's funny. I've listened to a couple of these podcasts and listened to your episode with Coach Sullivan or Coach DeWitt from Ohio Wesleyan. Like, a lot of coaches come from these coaching families or this sports family, and I didn't. Mine was very different. My parents were both kind of academics, and they didn't know much about sports at all at the time, but my mom just wanted me to kind of be active, and she wanted me to have some after-school activities. So she got me into basketball by just kind of putting me into a YMCA league after school, where we practice after school, play on the weekends. And for me, that kind of started my love for sports, and that was probably around the third grade. And from there, I played basketball, football, lacrosse, baseball, some years, all of them in the same year, pray for my parents. But for me, I always kind of just gravitated back to basketball. Like, I remember, like, we would have football practices in late August, early September, and we would practice from 5 to 7, and then there would still be daylight out. And even after football practice, I would want to go back and play one-on-one with my brother or two-on-two with the kids in the neighborhood. So no matter what sport it was, I always kind of gravitated back to basketball. So that's how I knew I loved basketball, but it kind of all came back to my mom just kind of wanting me to have an after-school activity.
It's funny how just a small little turn of the page can make such a difference in your life. And you think about if your mom had said, hey, why don't you go pick up the trumpet instead of, hey, why don't we get you involved in sports? It's just kind of amazing how things can kind of take a fork in the road.
Exactly. Like, me and my parents still talk about that. And she's like, I would have never anticipated you're going to make a career out of it. It was just something so you kind of stay active and stay healthy. And little do we know, 30 years later, I'm still actively involved in it. So it's wild.
Yeah. Now, do your parents know more about basketball now?
Oh, my mom is obsessed. It's nuts. Like, my mom watches more basketball than me, maybe. Like, she watches she watches the NBA game every night. Like, every night she'll text me like, hey, did you see Damian Lillard do this? Did you see Steph Curry do this? And like, half the time I'm like, mom, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, I didn't see the game, but she's obsessed with it.
That's awesome. That is very cool. It's amazing how somebody who really wasn't that interested in the game suddenly becomes interested. I'd say my mom was similar to that. Like, she met my dad, who was a sports guy. And not that my mom was not into athletics at all, but certainly she wasn't, you know, a fan. And now I'll talk to them and they're almost 80, and I'll talk to them on the phone and they'll be like, yeah, we were watching, there in Florida. So they'll be like, we were watching the Gators and this, and my mom's got opinions and my dad and all this stuff. It's just, it's funny how, again, the things that your kids get into, kind of how they followed through on just being able to watch your kid. And then that sort of generates your own interest as you go forward. So when you think back as a kid, and as you said, you keep gravitating back towards basketball, what do you remember about maybe that moment, or just sort of the gradual, as you started to take the game more seriously? Was there a point where you really started to get into it and think, hey, this is something that I really want to work on and get better? And then when that happened, what did that look like?
Yeah, so I would say that probably happened to me around high school. I played kind of every sport leading up to high school, but I think at most of the sports, I was mediocre at best, and compared to kind of just local upstate New York kids, like, basketball was absolutely my best sport. And it's like I said, it was the one that I enjoyed playing the most anyway. So around the ninth grade, that's when I decided, like, hey, I think I want to go do this in college. Like, I want to go play college basketball. I love this game anyway. So that's when I really, really started focusing on it. And that's when, like, after school every day, I would try to go to our YMCA, me and my brother, and we had another friend, and we would get shots up. We would work out. I started playing AAU basketball around the ninth grade time. And it just became an all year thing for me. And it kind of became an obsession for me. And it's funny, like, my friends at that point used to make a joke, like, they're like, do you have a cot in the YMCA? Because I just used to be there every single night after school until it closed. And it's just like, it was right around that ninth grade period where I really, really decided, like, hey, I want to try and play in college.
When you think about that time and wanting to be a college basketball player, what was your thought? What was your idea? What was your sort of framework of what that meant to be a college basketball player? Did you think about, hey, I'm going to go play at Duke or North Carolina? How much knowledge did you have about sort of what the process was like? Because I think it's always interesting to hear somebody talk about kind of where they fit. And obviously, as we go on, there's more and more information available to people about, hey, this is the level where you can play. But at a certain point, you got to kind of figure it out for yourself. So where was your level of knowledge, I guess, is my question.
Oh, I had none. Like, absolutely not. Ninth grade me thought I was going to make the NBA. But, it's funny. So, like, I was pretty good relatively. Like, I played freshman basketball, JV basketball, and I was always pretty good. But then when I got to varsity, I played on an exceptionally mediocre high school basketball team. But the league we played in, every other team had Division I guys, like high major guys. I think the best player in my league, my senior, ended up playing at Penn State. And when I got to the varsity level, that was when I really realized, I was like, hey, I'm not like these dudes. Like, these dudes are way better than me. So that's when I kind of realized, like, hey, I can, like, I think I could play college basketball, but, like, it's probably going to be small college basketball. And even then, I have to, like, find a niche and figure out, like, what I'm going to be really good at. But to me, it really didn't happen until, like, maybe even, like, the 10th grade year when I started watching varsity basketball games and saw, like, how good, really good players really are.
It's so true. I think that there's such a non-realistic view that a lot of people have when they start thinking about it. And of course, again, what do most people see on TV? You see Division I basketball. That's what people talk about a lot. And yet, at the same time, I think when you think about parents and kids, there's this, they just are not oftentimes realistic about what their kid can do. So for you to be able to kind of come to that realization and then sort of figure out, okay, what's my path to be able to do that, which we'll talk about in a second. When you think back to your high school career, do you have a favorite moment as a high school basketball player that stands out? It could be on or off the court.
Yeah, there's one win in particular that really stands out to me. I still kind of look back at it. And like, I'm still in a group chat with some of my high school basketball teammates and friends from high school, and we kind of talk about it from time to time. And it's, like I said, I played on an exceptionally mediocre team. And like, we had like three or four Division III guys on our team, and we played in a league where most of the good teams had Division I guys and multiple Division I guys. But there was a game where we were playing a team and their best kid went on to Belmont. I think their second best kid went on to Stonehill, and obviously they were way more talented than us, but I just kind of had it going this night. I think I had like 27 points in the first half, and we really played well as a team, and we ended up upsetting them. And for like our school, where like we had like three Division III guys and they had a couple Division I guys to go beat them, it was just like a big moment for our program and a big moment for our school. And it was just like, we ended up losing in the playoffs a couple weeks later, but that to us was our championship game. And it was just a moment that we always think about. And it was just a cool memory at the time to just go knock out Goliath when we felt like David.
Well, hey, if somebody's putting up 27 in the first half, that's pretty good.
I can shoot a little. I can shoot. I like, not with any defense, but if you zone me in high school, I can make some shots.
All right. Well, there you go. Hey, not many guys get a chance to score 27 and a half. So that's pretty solid. All right. So as you start to look at the college recruiting process and you start thinking about making a decision about where you want to go, just talk a little bit about your college decision, how you went about it, and sort of what that process was like for you.
Yeah. So in high school, I played on a mediocre team, but I think we kind of overperformed expectations both years. I think I had a really, really good high school coach, and he did a really good job of just getting the most out of our talents and just kind of putting us in positions where we can succeed. So my numbers were always pretty good in high school, and we won more games than people thought in a really, really good league. And so I was recruited by most of the New York Division III. So I was recruited by like the SUNYACs, the Liberty Leagues, the Empire 8 schools. And the way I kind of ended up, and one of those schools was Hartwick, which was at that time coached by Todd McGinnis, who's now the head coach at Case Western Reserve. And that's actually where I ended up. And the reason I kind of ended up at Hartwick was I really bought into what Coach McGinnis's vision was. And for him, he was a young coach and he saw potential in Hartwick, and he thought Hartwick could be a conference championship winning program, a program that can play in the NCAA tournament. And because in high school, I never really experienced winning at a really high level, I wanted to go somewhere where I knew we had a chance to win, and I knew we had a chance to compete in the NCAA tournament. And with that combined with kind of the geographic factors and kind of the academic factors of the school, made Hartwick kind of the perfect choice for me. But it all started because I really just bought in on Coach McGinnis' vision, and I just wanted to be a part of a high-level winning program. That was the most important thing to me.
From a school standpoint, what were you thinking about in terms of career or major when you first went to school?
Yeah, so when I first entered college, I thought I was, like, at least in my mind, I thought I was going to go into law school. But I think if you were to ask my parents or any of my family members or friends from when I was a kid, I think they would have told you that, like, I was definitely going to at least try coaching in some way. Because, I actually just over Christmas break, I was hanging out with my brother, and I was talking to him about, like, we were talking about, like, how I got into coaching and my path and everything like that. And he was like, hey, man, I knew you were going to go to coaching when you were 14 years old because all these other kids, they were playing Madden and they were playing like my player mode, and you're the only dude I've ever saw buy NFL coach and play the coach mode on it. So he was like, that's what you were going to do that. And so like, even though I thought I was going to go to law school until my senior year, I think my family had kind of a hunch that like I would at least try it out when I was younger.
That's funny. I mean, there's always two paths that typically you hear of all the interviews that I've done. Most people fall into one of two categories. Either it's the person who was 8 and was drawing plays on a napkin and knew that they wanted to coach from that time, or there's also the path where somebody's playing and they get done, all of a sudden they look around, they're like, what? The game is gone. I can't do anything. And maybe I go and I get a business job and all of a sudden I'm like, yeah, this stinks. I want to get back and be involved in basketball. And then they get back into coaching. So yours is almost a hybrid of that, where maybe people around you knew, but you weren't really sure. You didn't really know, or you didn't really see that directly, that was going to be the direction that you went. So talk a little bit about your experience as a player at Hartwick and maybe what you learned as we think about moving forward here with you as a coach. Maybe what you learned from Coach McGinnis during your time with him.
Yeah. So personally, I was not a very good player in college. Like, I just had some flaws in my game and we were really good and I played behind some really good players. But I really, really loved my experience in college because, one, I wanted to be a part of a program that won games, and we absolutely won a ton of games. Like, we made 3 NCAA tournaments in my 4 years, and my sophomore year, I think we started off the year 14-0. And so I played on some good teams, and I really, really had a strong relationship with Coach McGinnis. And that, for me, gave me a really good experience, even though I personally wasn't a good player myself. And when I went into my senior year, actually, like, I had a knee injury, and that kind of combined with the fact that I knew I was never going to be a really big on-the-court contributor at the college level, I talked to Coach McGinnis, and he allowed me to be a student assistant for him. And while working for him as a student assistant, I was really able to understand, like, what makes him such a good coach. And for me, I think what he does, as well as any coach I've ever been around, and it's something that I try to do with my players, is rather than just being stuck in, hey, this is how I want to play, or this is how I envision basketball being played, he did such a good job of kind of catering the team to allow his best players to be the best versions of themselves. And he always talked about, like, hey, if we can't make our best players good, we're not very good coaches. And for me, that's kind of always stuck. And to this day, like, I'm always trying to figure out, like, hey, what are the strengths of our players? What do our players do really well? And how do we maximize that? And that's something I absolutely directly got from Coach McGinnis.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's, when you look at and think about what makes somebody a good coach, I think obviously everybody has differing levels of talent, and clearly the more talent you have, the easier it is to win games. But by the same token, I think the best coaches get the most out of their players, and they try their best to get the most out of them and do whatever they can to put them in the best position to be able to succeed. And I think when you do that, that's the mark to me of somebody who really knows what they're doing and does a great job as a coach. So when you get that opportunity to work with Coach McGinnis, you obviously go from being a player to that relationship now changes, where you're part of the staff and you kind of get to go behind the scenes and take a look at, well, hey, what is coaching really all about? Do you remember if there were some things that surprised you as you kind of got behind the curtain and got to know Coach McGinnis and sort of know what went on?
Yeah.
Rather from a player perspective, but more from a coach perspective.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest shock right away was kind of how many hard decisions you had to make and how many conversations you had to have with players. And like, when you're a player, you don't necessarily understand like why coaches are making certain decisions. Like, you're, as a player, sometimes like you're kind of in this blinded tunnel where you're really focused on like, hey, what does the coach think about me? And a lot of times, like, some players, like, and like, this isn't always the case, but a lot of times, sometimes players are like, hey, coach doesn't like me, coach doesn't like this, whatever. But one of the things I really noticed when I started working as a coach under him is, hey, he really wants to make every player happy. He would love if he could play everyone, but he has to do what's best for the team. And even though, like, sometimes, like, he would love to play someone because they're a great kid and they that he likes being with them and they do all the right things, but sometimes you just got to play the kid that's going to help you win games. And that internal struggle, those conversations in the office, those really those are some things I just never anticipated, because you don't see that side as a player. You don't realize coaches go through all those conversations, and it's just something that's absolutely necessary. And it really kind of opened my eyes to the coaching profession.
What did you love about it right away? Like, as soon as you get in there and you're like, all right, I'm transitioning from player to coach, what part of coaching right away did you take to?
Yeah, I loved kind of at that point two things. Like, one, I love the relationships that you can build with players. Like, especially like when, like, and I loved how players just kind of, if you can have strong relationships with them, and I obviously did, especially some of the upperclassmen, because they were my literal classmates.
But
if you can have relationships with them, that they would trust you and they would go ask you different questions. And as an assistant, like, they would come to you, even the younger guys, like, they would come to me as an assistant and ask me different basketball things, talk to me about their personal lives. And it was just, I love building that relationship aspect of it. And that's something I still enjoy to this day. And then the other thing I still really enjoy, and this was probably my favorite part of my entire senior year, was coach was really good at kind of involving everyone in game plans. And obviously, as a student assistant, like, I didn't have much input, but I was there watching film with them. I was seeing what, like, the coaching staff was talking about. And for me, just that puzzle aspect of kind of figuring out a game plan, figuring out how to figure out what to do against an opponent to put your team in the best position to succeed. I love that aspect of coaching. And to this day, like, I love watching film of my assistants. I love breaking down film. I love trying to figure out how do we beat our opponent and put ourselves in the best position to succeed. And it's just like a puzzle to me, and I love that.
How much film are you watching of other teams and other programs to kind of get ideas? Do you do a lot of that in the off season?
Yeah, we do a ton of that. Like just today, actually, me and my assistants were watching an Arizona game, because when we were at the Final Four, we watched Tommy Lloyd do a clinic, and we kind of loved some of the concepts he was talking about. So we were watching a bunch of Arizona film on Synergy, trying to figure out, like, what are the different things they do, how they get into different actions. But yeah, we try to do that a couple times a week, of watching either Division III programs, Division II programs that we think really highly up, or we think they do similar stuff to what we want to do, or even high major programs, NBA teams. Like, we try to soak in as much film as possible. Like, we always tell the players, like, just like they, we want them to work on their game, we want them to work on their shot, do work hard in the offseason. We got to do the exact same thing, continue to improve as coaches and continue to improve what we want to do on the floor.
So much easier than for us old guys, man. We used to have to do that on VHS tape. And
oh my God, Synergy is a game changer.
Yeah. I mean, hitting the rewind button. Yeah, it's amazing how easy it is to be able to watch stuff and pull things up. It's just, it's crazy. You told somebody who was a coach in the 80s and 90s the way things are now, and they, oof, man, put them in a time machine. They wouldn't even recognize what watching film looks like today. So, all right, so you graduate, you got a degree in business. Was there any thought of going and getting a regular job, or was that point you were sold on coaching and started looking for coaching jobs?
Yeah, I was sold on coaching in like the first semester of my senior year. Like, when I was that student assistant, like, I knew this is what I wanted to do. It's like I said, like, at that point, I was part of some really good teams. I was part of a coaching staff of a team that was making the NCAA tournament. We were really good at the point. And for me, I couldn't envision getting out of basketball and not at least giving it a shot. So yeah, going into the real world, going into getting a 9-to-5 job at that point was never even in the question for me. I was at least going to give it a chance.
I can completely understand. So I think I've told this story on the podcast, but I'll share it with you real quick. So I graduated and I had a degree in business administration, same as you. And to be honest, I was one of those people that I had never really thought about coaching at all, never even crossed my mind. And then when I went out to get a job, and my parents were both teachers, so my dad was a professor at Cleveland State, my mom taught second grade. And so I had never seen anybody work in the summer. So the summer I graduated, I went and had some interviews. And I remember I had this interview with Nestle, the big, you know, like, international food company. And at some point they're like, I think I went for a second interview, and they're like, hey, we want to hire you, and, you know, you're going to report to work on July 1st. And I remember going, wait, I got to put on a suit and go to work when it's like 90 degrees in July? Because I had never seen anybody work in the summertime. My dad maybe once in a while would teach a summer school class or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I think I'm going to go back to school and see if I can get into coaching and maybe become a teacher. And I guess I had already thought about maybe trying to go and be a GA, but the year that I graduated was when all Division I schools cut from two GAs to one. So everybody kind of had them staggered. So there was basically no jobs anywhere in the entire country. And so anyway, so that was my long story into how I got to teaching and coaching. So talk a little about your first experience, and you go to Michigan Dearborn. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about how you got there and how that opportunity came to you.
Yeah. So after graduating, like I wanted to go get a coaching position. I didn't know anything about the business outside of like what it was physically to coach on the floor at the time. So I was just on HoopDirt applying to every single job I can. Like I just wanted to get a coaching position. And Coach Langley at the University of Michigan Dearborn was the first coach to kind of get back to me. And he offered me, it was essentially a volunteer position, but I was so excited to just get a coaching position that I jumped aboard and I hopped on his coaching staff. And like looking back, it was interesting because I knew nothing about the NAIA level. I knew nothing about moving out to the Midwest, living in Detroit, but I just wanted to coach so bad that for me, if whoever was the first person to offer me a coaching position, I was going to take it. And so that's kind of how I ended up at Dearborn.
And so you ended up making a ton of money and living in a really nice apartment. Is that how it went?
Exactly. So much money that I had to work to make ends meet. I was like a branch manager or a shift manager at the local Detroit YMCA, and I had to work from 5 a.m. to 5 a.m. to noon every single morning. And then at noon, I would run over to the basketball office and try to get ready and do everything we had to do on the basketball court before practice in the evening. But yeah, those were some long days for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, I think anybody who's in that position, we've talked to so many people that have gone this similar path to what you've gone on, and just, you know, they're working for free, you're volunteering, or you're making a very minimum, or you're a GA, or whatever it might be. And yeah, you got to put a lot of time in and do a lot of work. But I think one of the things that universally guys have told us is that those first experiences when, again, you're young, you're single, you got lots of time, and you can kind of run on that level of energy that it takes to be able to follow the schedule that you're talking about, you learn so much in those experiences. So what do you remember from that year, that something that you take that is still part of who you are today?
Yeah, I mean, like the biggest thing I learned, and this is both from my experiences and coaching that team, was just their element of kind of resiliency. And I think like as a coach, it's really important. Like obviously, you know, like the profession is up and down. Like we're relying on 18-year-old kids. Like you got to be resilient. You got to be able to just get up the next morning, just do your thing. And as a program, I think Coach Langley did such a good job of kind of instilling resiliency, toughness, instilling that culture within the team. To kind of give you a little bit of background, like before Coach Langley got to Michigan Dearborn, they never had a winning season ever in program history. And in within 3 years, he got that program into the NAIA national title. And that first year, like we were taking our bumps for sure. Like we had our struggles. I think we started off the season 0-7, but all he would talk about is resiliency. All he would talk about is a process and getting up the next day and just making sure that we're continuing to just do our best, continue to raise the standard. And to this day, like that's still stuff I'm trying to bring to Oberlin. I'm still trying to talk to our guys about, because I think it's important, not just on the basketball court, but in life. And it was just that year really was a year where I kind of, everything about that year was just about being resilient to me.
I think when you talk about being able to rebuild a program, to me, that's a skill that I think it takes a special kind of skill set to be able to come in, because obviously it's not just changing what goes on the basketball floor, but you're also talking about changing the culture and trying to put that in place. And as we get to your experience at Oberlin this year, we'll get to that part of it, I think. But to me, being able to turn around a program that doesn't have that winning tradition, I always think that the guys that can do that, it's just a special skill set that I don't think everybody has. And so for you to be able to learn that right away and learn it early, it has to be a huge advantage. You're there for one season and then you go to SUNY Purchase. Talk a little bit about that. Get to go back east.
Yeah, and that was honestly the number one reason I took the position is I wanted to kind of get back to the Division III level. I love the Division III level. I think it's such a pure form of basketball, such a pure form of coaching. And I got a chance to kind of be closer to family, closer to some friends. And so, yeah, I took the job at SUNY Purchase. And it's funny, like every coach I've worked for, like I think I'm unique in the sense that I work for so many different coaches, and I moved around a lot in the profession in a really short time. But every single program, every single coach I work for taught me something different. And at SUNY Purchase, it was an interesting position. Like the program had been wildly, wildly successful on the floor. Like we played them when I was at Hartwick, and they beat in the NCAA tournament twice in my career, and they beat us up pretty badly. They're really talented. And then the year before I got to Purchase, they kind of had some off-court stuff. They had a coaching change. And my boss, Kyle Martin, his job was to not only kind of continue the success of the basketball program, but was kind of clean up the academic side, clean up the presence our guys had in the school and within the culture of the institution. So what I learned from Kyle Martin is not just how to build a successful basketball program, but how to address tougher issues, how to build your team's reputation within the campus community, how to get your guys to care about more than just winning or losing. And at a place where that was such an important part of the hiring process, it was just really good for me to learn how to kind of build a program and run a program that's successful, not just on the basketball court, but off it as well.
So what did that look like? And what does that look like? Let's jump ahead. As you try to institute that in your program, when you're a head coach, what does that look like? What did you learn during that year? And then what have you applied to your situation currently at Oberlin?
Yeah, so one of the things I learned that year, and we try to talk to our players about this every single day, is there needs to be a championship mindset. There needs to be a standard of excellence that you approach every single situation in. And we talk to our guys about how if we're going to build a championship program here at Oberlin, it's not just about, hey, getting on the court and making more shots than the other team. That making more shots than the other team comes as a result of the process of approaching every single situation you do to the best of your ability. So for us, when we talk to our guys, when we talk about their life, when we talk about school, the biggest thing we talk about aren't necessarily the results of what they're doing, not necessarily their grades, but hey, did you give everything you have in this situation? Did you try to put yourself in a position to succeed? And sometimes it's human nature, you don't. But if you didn't, then we try to figure out why that happened, why you didn't put yourself in a position to succeed. And we try to make sure that that doesn't happen moving forward. And the biggest thing we try to do year one is make sure our guys understood the mentality of being a champion and make sure they understood that they have to approach every single situation with the standard of excellence.
What does that look like in terms of an action that you want to see from your guys, whether that's when they're on campus, whether they're in class, whether that's on the practice floor, in the locker room? Just give me a concrete thing that you want your guys to do that when you talk about, hey, we want to compete at a championship level, we want to do everything at this championship level. What's an example of that that's kind of feet on the ground?
Sure. So I'll give you a couple different examples. So academically, that means if they have like a test, are you making sure they're preparing for that test? And let's just not make sure you're cramming it in the day before the test. Let's let's prepare ourselves. Everyone gets syllabuses. Let's make sure that you plan out your study schedule. You're organizing yourself. Make sure you're staying on top of your work. So when the test comes, you're absolutely putting in your position to succeed. Now, the test might not go your way, but in the end of the day, if you can say, hey, I worked hard and I put myself in this position to succeed, that's all you can do. On the court, it's the exact same thing. Like we tell our guys all the time, hey, you can't control whether shots are going to go in and out. You just can't. But what you can control is how hard you work to become a really good shooter. What you can control is how hard you play every single time you're on the floor. If you can control how good a teammate you are, how you can interact with other people on the floor and off the floor. So those are the things that we really try to put into our guys is, hey, let's figure out this process. And I'm a big believer that if you can figure out the process to be successful, then the success is going to come. Like if our guys work really hard at being good shooters, if our guys get on the gun and shoot a ton and take game shots and really focus on it, they will become better shooters. It's inevitable. And I think that has to do with every single thing they do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the process piece of it is something that when you start to look at what you want to do as a coach, it really makes such a difference when you have somebody who's coaching the process instead of always coaching the outcome. And you can watch, and you and I talked a little about AAU basketball before we jumped on here, but you can go and watch AAU basketball or even high school basketball, and you'll see examples where player does everything right and the outcome isn't good and coach gets mad, or conversely, everything goes wrong and for some reason the outcome turns out to be good and coach is all excited. And I think ultimately what you're doing there with your players is you're teaching them those bad habits that you don't want to instill, versus if you talk about the process, yeah, you can play great defense and sometimes guy just makes a great shot, right? But you still have to look at, well, how's the process of what we did to get there? Were we in the right places? Were we making the right calls? Were we communicating? All those things. And sometimes, again, guys are going to score, or sometimes a shot misses even though we run the offense and do everything exactly. We make the right reads and it just doesn't go in. So I think that process piece of it to me is hugely important when you start talking about what you want to do in terms of building the right habits for your guys and building those championship habits. So that to me is something that makes a ton of sense when you start looking at, especially taking over a new program like you did this past season. Talk about your two other assistant coaching stops before you end up getting your first head job, first at Clarkson and then at the University of Chicago. Obviously, at the University of Chicago, you have a similar situation to what you have at Oberlin in terms of academics. So just talk a little bit about those two stops.
Yeah, so Clarkson and the University of Chicago were great for me because they were kind of my first two introductions into the kind of this high academic realm. And I absolutely fell in love with this realm of basketball. Like our guys are, like, I think our guys have kind of the right perspective. Like, all of our guys are here for the right reasons. Basketball is really important to them. But they understand, like, they also want a really good education. Our guys are, for being college kids, they're really mature. I feel like I'm coaching adults for the most part. And I absolutely fell in love with this level. Now, at Clarkson, Jeff Gorski is one of my best friends still in the business. From him, I really learned kind of how to run a good practice. Like, he's one of the most organized guys that I've ever met in my entire life. He's really, really efficient with his time. And I thought we did a really good job at that at Clarkson, just making sure that we were really prepared. Like, we didn't waste a second of practice time. Every single thing was planned out. Every drill had a purpose. Our guys were flying around the practice floor. And I thought he did a really good job getting his guys prepared. And then my final assistant stop was kind of this end all be all to how to run an incredible program. Coach McGrath, unlike the other coaches I work for who were kind of new at all of their stops, Coach McGrath was an institution at the University of Chicago. I think he had been there 25 years when I had gotten there. He made Elite Eights. He's made Sweet 16s. And like from the University of Chicago, the biggest thing I kind of learned was how to run this incredible program. Like, Coach McGrath had everything under his thumb. Alumni Giving Day, whether it was making sure like our professors in the school knew athletics existed, like it was every single thing. Coach McGrath knew, had a way, he had a process, he understood how to run this program at a bigger level. And to me, like, that's still stuff that I try to do, and I'm not anywhere as good as he is. Like, he is so good at just running the program at a big picture level. But for me, it was like the final thing I needed to learn. Like, I got, like, through all these different coaching styles, I learned different elements of recruiting, different elements of running a practice, different elements of dealing with players. But that was kind of a bow tie. Like, all right, this is the macro level of how to run a really, really successful program. So I was really thankful for all the coaching stops I had as an assistant. I'm really close with all the head coaches I work for still. And I think all of them kind of taught me different aspects of being a coach. And I don't know if other people have the same experiences I have working for all these different coaches who have different styles, but I know for me, it's made me a better coach, I think.
When did you start looking around for head coaching jobs? Was that just during that season at the University of Chicago? Had you looked before? Did you feel like you were ready? Obviously, you go and you get the job at SUNY Canton, but just tell me a little bit about when you first started looking.
Yeah, so it was during that year at the University of Chicago. Until the University of Chicago, I never really felt I was ready yet. I thought I was getting better and better, but I never thought I could run my own program. And then working for Coach McGrath, I kind of had a feeling after that year that, like, hey, I don't know if I'm ready yet, but I think I'm gonna try at least. I think I'm in a position where I can give it a running try. And so it was after that season working at the University of Chicago where I really started applying for head coaching positions.
What was the interview process like?
Yeah, so I applied that year for kind of every small college Division III job in the Northeast, and I got two interviews, and then one of them was SUNY Canton, and then I got SUNY Canton, and I used Chad O'Donnell on one of his clients, and he did a really good job preparing me for the interview. But I still remember like the first time I talked to him, he does a really good job preparing his clients to succeed in the interview process. But the first time I spoke with him, we did like a mock interview, and he goes, "That was the worst thing I've ever heard." He goes, "You are not going to get this job." But then he got me better. Like we worked at it, and like it's, I try to drill myself. Like I treated it like I was a player, where like I would sit down in front of a mirror and ask myself questions and answer over and over and over again. And I got myself to a point where I felt comfortable in the interview process. And I really connected with the people I can, because Canton and Clarkson are actually 10 minutes from each other. So I had a familiarity with the area. It was similar type of people. And I just connected well with them, and I had a really good interview process. And that's kind of how I ended up at Canton.
In that original interview with Chad, who we've had on the podcast, who's great, by the way, but what was bad about your answers? I'm just curious, like what made you a bad interviewee at that point?
Yeah, Chad will tell you, when I'm nervous, I can get very robotic. So he was always like, "Hey man, like talk like a person." like he goes he's like, "You look like you're just reading a text." So yeah, that was the biggest thing. It was just like getting comfortable. Like I always kind of like I was good at kind of like understanding what I needed to say. And I always like had good thoughts. Like Chad would tell me, like, "I think like what you're trying to say is good," but he goes like, "You got to deliver it in a way that's presentable." And I think like early on, like especially in my first head coaching interview, my first like real like interview process, I just wasn't ready for that yet, because I wanted the job so bad that I was just kind of nervous, and I was kind of just almost recited like it was a test rather than having a conversation with someone.
Yeah, you have to kind of go through it and be able to be yourself, for lack of a better way of saying it. I know that if I go back and listen to some of my first podcasts, Jason and I will do this sometimes and go back and listen to me, you're like, "Oh God, it's terrible. Like who listened to these things?" And obviously over time you get better and you're still always trying to grow and improve. But I think the interview process is sort of the same way. You got to get kind of comfortable with the kind of questions they're going to ask. And then you got to let your true personality shine through and be the person who you are and be the kind of coach that you're going to be. And that way they can kind of see the real you. And that's how you end up eventually, I think, conquering that and being able to get the job. So you transition from a multi-time assistant coach to a head coach. What do you remember about the first week or two on that job trying to figure out, okay, now I'm the head coach, and yeah, I just watched Coach McGrath do all this program stuff like you described, but now he's not doing that stuff. I got to do that stuff. So just what do you remember about that initial couple weeks on the job and what that was like?
Yeah, so the first couple weeks were absolutely a whirlwind. Like it's like, I think like you can work as an assistant for a long time, but until you're a head coach, like you just don't know what's going to be thrown at you. And so the second I got there in the job, like I was trying to do a million things at once, and it was just kind of a whirlwind. And I still remember like I had a conversation with Jeff Gorski at that time, because like Jeff Gorski is still one of my good friends, and he coached at Clarkson, like I said, which is 10 minutes from SUNY Canton. And he was just like, "Hey, just focus on doing a couple of things really well right now. Like, don't focus on just running this huge program. Like, focus on doing a couple things really, really well. And then from there, just start building." And I thought that was really good advice for me at the time, because then I really tried. I remember sitting down in my office and I really thought, I'm like, "Hey, what's really, really important at this institution at that time. And for me, that was one, I wanted to connect with all of my players. So I ended up calling every single one of my players. It was over the summer, really connecting with them, talking to them about their experiences. I really tried to hit the road recruiting. And because it was a place where we could still kind of get in transfers, we can get kids in late there. And then I try to just make myself known around the campus. And just having those three tangible things that I knew I could do, that I knew I can actually like get work done towards, that helped me kind of get moving in the process of becoming a head coach and helped me get ready. And then from there, it was just different things came up, as you know, to this day as a head coach, like different new things pop up every single day. But I'm really happy I had that conversation with Coach Gorski just to kind of settle me down, because I do remember the first couple of days are absolute whirlwinds, and I'm sure they are for a lot of young coaches.
I love that, because I equate that to being on the practice floor, where you can watch and you can pick out a million different things during a practice that you're like, oh, I'd like to fix that, or oh, we got to get better at that, or oh, we can do that. And then if you end up not focusing on anything, you end up doing 100 things and you don't do any of them well, versus if you kind of come into your practices with an idea of, hey, here's the three most important things that we have to work on, or you come into a season with, these are the three things that are non-negotiable that we have to get done. It's sort of the same thing what you're describing, where, yeah, you came into a new program, and I'm sure that I can't even put a number on how many different things you probably wanted to touch and get started on, and hey, I got to do this, I got to do that. But obviously you can't do all of them, and certainly if you're going to try, you're not going to do them very well. So that's great advice, to be able to just, hey, come in and I got to work on, these are the three most important things, or these are the three things that are most important right now, and that's what I got to focus on. And then you knock those out and then you can move on to something else.
Exactly.
And I think that's a really, really good mindset. When you think about being a head coach and you think about what it was like when you were an assistant, and clearly there's a difference in the mentality, there's a difference in the responsibility. When you're an assistant coach and the team wins or the team loses, that one loss doesn't go on your record, it goes on the head coach's record. And so I think that as an assistant coach, it's oftentimes you look at the head coach, you're like, man, why are you doing that? Or why don't you do this? And then I think when you get in that head coaching chair, you realize that there's some things that maybe as an assistant you look at that seem like they're kind of easy, but when you are in the head coaching position, you realize they're a little bit more difficult. Is there anything that you can point to that little story that I just told kind of rings a bell for you, of something that you thought as an assistant that you're like, oh man, come on, why isn't he doing that? And now you realize as a head coach, well, maybe there was a reason why.
It's so funny you said that, because when I was an assistant under Coach McGrath, I was like, I thought, like, he'll still make fun of me for it. He was like, I had an answer for everything. Like, I thought, like, we would watch film, and I'm like, Coach, we just got to do this, and we got it. And I got, like, I remember my first season as a head coach, we're doing, like, game prep for the first time. And like, how to guard like a certain action. We had like a couple different options. And I was like, I have no clue. I don't know what to do right now. And I called Coach McGrath, and I was like, Coach, what would you do here? And he goes, he was like, the irony is incredible right now, because this is the first time you don't know what you don't know the answer to something.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That is funny. But I think it's so true. I mean, I just think that as an assistant, you're sitting there and you're like, man, it seems obvious, or man, there's this. And then you don't necessarily realize that there's some other things at play when head coaches make decisions that the assistant coaches just don't have to take into account, that you certainly do as a head coach. When you think about the way that you want your teams to play, obviously as a first-time head coach, you've taken things, as you talked about, from all the different stops that you've been, from all the different coaches that you've had the opportunity to work with, different playing styles, different ways of building their team. Where were you in terms of sort of your style of play, how you wanted to play, your overall coaching philosophy as you first get that job? Were you pretty confident in, this is what I want to do? Or were you still kind of like, hey, I gotta figure this out as I'm going along and kind of look at my personnel? Or just where were you in terms of style of play and philosophy?
Yeah, so I had kind of some big picture ideas. Like, the one thing I always believed in is I thought, in order to win big games and in order to be consistently successful, you had to be tough, you had to be physical, and you had to be good defensively. And so and then offensively, like, I wanted to use some kind of ball screen stuff, but I didn't have, like, because I work for Todd and I work for different coaches that were kind of big on just maximizing your player's talent, I didn't have a set view of what that looked like. So for me, like, I came in and I had an idea of like how to work on defense. I had an idea of like how to be a really good rebounding team, how to emphasize that. I had an idea of like how to kind of build a good practice plan. But it wasn't until I really started diving into SUNY Canton and diving into our personnel that I realized like, hey, we have really, really good post players. We have some guys who are good with the ball, but we may not be the best shooting team in the world. So let's just kind of pound it high-low, trying to figure out weird spacing where it'd be tough to help for us and try to play high-low basketball. But for me, like, it's not, like that year, like, we won the conference championship, and one of my good friends coached in that league already, and he watched our conference championship game. He's like, hey, you guys are really good, but you brought basketball back 50 years because we played two posts, walked it up the floor to play high-low basketball for 40 minutes. And it's not like I came in, I was like, hey, that's what we're going to do coming into it. But just, we had a 7-for-1 kid who was awesome in that league. We had another 6'8" 4 man who was awesome. And we were like, I was just decided like, hey, let's play both of these guys together. And it's going to be really hard to guard. And we just did that. But with that, I always knew like I wanted to be a team that's going to be really good on the boards, really good defensively, and just tough and physical. And that's kind of the standard. Even today at Oberlin, our personnel is wildly different than that Canton team. But it's, in terms of style of play, in terms of identity, those are things that we still talk about to this day. It's just that physicality, just that toughness, just that defensive mentality approaching every single game.
All right, after your 3 years at Canton, come to Oberlin. Obviously, a really high academic institution for people who aren't aware, but tell me a little bit about the why behind coming to Oberlin.
Yeah, so one, I always wanted to get back into high academic basketball. Like for me, the beliefs of Oberlin as an institution, the degree that students get here, kind of really do kind of line up with everything I believe what college basketball should be, what higher education should be. So Oberlin, when the job opened up, I already kind of knew a little bit about the institution and kind of about high academic basketball working at Chicago and Clarkson. So that already intrigued me. And then when I started digging through Oberlin, looking at and going through the interview process and talking to the administration here and talking to different coaches, what really, really made me excited for this job was I saw an incredible amount of potential. Like, obviously, the league is incredible. There's so much history in the league. There's so many good teams in the league. And it's a league where if you can win the league, you can compete with everyone. And even though that could be kind of frightening at times, like the fact that Oberlin has so much potential, I think it's kind of in this new era of athletics where there's an emphasis in athletics. We have resources now. We can get the type of kids we need to win games. All of that kind of sold me on how this is, when you combine that with the type of institution, the beliefs of Oberlin, with it being such a great academic institution, for me, I felt like it was an absolute home run of a fit. And to be honest, like, I'm 11 months in, almost a year in now, and I feel exactly the same. Like, I feel like it's, for me, this is the perfect fit as an institution and as a basketball program for me.
What kind of questions did you ask them during your interview process to help you to get a better understanding of making sure that it was the right fit for you? Because obviously, as you just said, you're doing some research, you're learning more about the school itself, you're learning about the basketball program. What were some questions that you had for them?
Yeah, the biggest thing I had for them is I wanted to know about kind of the history of Oberlin athletics and like what was their thoughts on why like some teams haven't been as successful and why there wasn't a ton of NCAC success at Oberlin and what they're doing to address that. And I just kind of wanted to hear their perspective and I wanted to see kind of the changes that have been made in recent years. And when I talked to kind of our athletic director, when I talked to different coaches, when I talked to our head of admissions, like a lot of the things that kind of I thought made Oberlin a really, really challenging job in the past, I think they're actively working on resolving them and while keeping the institutional core and institutional mission of what Oberlin really is. And for me, like because I was able to kind of get those answers, I felt comfortable that this is a place that not only can you provide students a really good education, but you can actually win at a really high level if you do it the right way. And for me, so it was all about asking about kind of the past and how they kind of viewed, how they wanted to move forward in building a high level athletic program.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. When you come in, and obviously you have guys that are already a part of the program that you didn't bring in, and so they're having to adjust to, okay, we got a new coach. What's this guy going to be like? What's he all about? Tell me a little bit about some of your first contact with the returning players and what those conversations look like from your perspective, what you're trying to get across to the guys that had been there before.
Yeah, so one of the luxuries I had when I got Oberlin was school was still in session. And that was a little bit different than SUNY Canton because I got the job at Canton in July, so I had to make calls over the phone. And because I got the job in April, I was able to meet with every single one of our returning players face to face. And my biggest thing was I just wanted to kind of talk to them about their experiences. I wanted to see what they liked. I wanted to see things that they didn't necessarily appreciate that happened in the past. I wanted to see kind of what their expectations were. And I just kind of wanted to see how much they cared about basketball, how much they cared about success. And so I just met with each of them individually, and what kind of really at that point like made me feel comfortable with the decision I made leaving kind of a winning program at SUNY Canton and coming to Oberlin was I had a conversation with one of our rising seniors at that time. He just finished his junior year and they hadn't had a coach for 4-6 weeks at the time. And I was like, hey, so what have you guys been doing in the spring? Like, what have you guys been doing in the off season? And he kind of pulled out a notebook and he gave me the exact plan of exactly what they're doing. He's like, hey, coach, we're lifting 4 times a week. We're playing pickup these days. These are the scheduled hours where the gym is open. I'm making sure guys are getting the gym, getting shots up. And right there, I knew like our guys really cared about being successful on the basketball court. Like I knew like, hey, even though there might have not been a history of tremendous success in the past, we had guys that really wanted to win. And we had really good guys who wanted to be leaders on the floor. And just having that in the program when you're walking in and you have guys that are already intrinsically motivated makes you just feel that much better. And that's when I felt really comfortable that I made the right choice. And that's held true to this day. We have really intrinsically motivated guys. And obviously at the Division III level, you know, where you don't have a ton of time in the off season with your guys, that's really important when you're trying to rebuild and kind of build a program from the ground up. But we absolutely have that, and it's something we look forward to when we recruit guys now. But it's day one with those conversations when I was really trying to get to know and build relationships. That's something I found out right away.
Yeah, to be able to have that in place already as you take the job, man, that's a huge bonus because clearly, I think anybody who's coaching at the Division III level, like you said, there's limited access to your players in the off season. You guys are getting 8 days now, so that's.
I'm so excited for that.
I know every D3 guy we talk to is like, man, 8 days is gonna be great. Everybody's super excited, but clearly, again, there's a whole portion of the off season where it's up to your guys, right? It's up to your leaders. It's up to your upperclassmen. It's up to the guys that to get in the gym themselves and to get in the weight room and to do all the things that you're describing. So to already have somebody in place or multiple guys in place that are kind of leading that charge, I'm sure was invaluable to you. Another piece that you had to get in place was your coaching staff. So just talk a little bit about what that's like as a head coach trying to put together a staff and just how you went about that process.
Yeah, so I got really lucky. So I have 2 assistant coaches and I think they're tremendous. Like I always say, like they could be head coaches right now. And I think at this level, having 2 guys with the experiences they have, with the places they've been as coaches and the things they've done as coaches, I think I'm incredibly, incredibly fortunate. My one assistant, I've known him since he was 7 years old. He was my little brother's best friend. He actually went to Hartwick. We actually just missed each other by a year, but he played at Hartwick too. And I've kind of seen him progress in the coaching career. Like he was a GA at a Division I school. He was coaching Division I junior college basketball for a while. And for him, like he kind of just like he's a Division III guy by heart, and he kind of just missed kind of what Division III basketball was all about, and the purity of the recruiting there, and the purity of kind of not having to worry about your guys' academics, and more just you coach basketball like we coach basketball. And he wanted to kind of get back to that. And I know how much he works, and I know how good a coach he is. So when he wanted the job, it was a no-brainer for me. So that was my first hire. And then my other assistant, Nate, it was funny. He has so much experience. He was a Division I assistant at Sacramento State for 10 years. He knows so much about basketball, and he just like they had a coaching change at Sacramento, and he's originally from Toledo, and he wanted to give small college basketball a try while getting kind of closer to family back in Ohio. So he just kind of emailed me, and he was like, "Hey, I'm looking to get back to Ohio. Do you have an open coaching position?" And luckily enough, I did. So I talked to him on the phone, and immediately we kind of connected. I thought we kind of believed in the same things in terms of like macro level philosophy. So I ended up hiring him, and this staff is so awesome to have because of how experienced these guys are and because of how good of coaches they are. For me, I'm like, I don't feel like I'm their boss. Like it's more like we're three peers working together to help build this program. And they're every day, like I always tell them, like, just like I hope that I'm teaching our guys stuff and I'm teaching them stuff, they teach me something every single day. And they, like as we're watching film, as we're going through all these different things we're doing as a staff, like I learn from them, I grow from them just like they're growing from me. And I think at this level, at small college basketball, to have a coaching staff like that, I think it's really special. And I know I'm fortunate for that.
How do you handle the delegation piece of it? Are you good at it at this point? Is it still something that you kind of struggle with because you like to have your hands and everything? Just where are you in giving them things that they need to do to help build the program?
Yeah. So I think one of the best things all the coaches I work for did, and this is every single one of them, was they were all delegators. And one of the things I was taught really early on was one of your jobs as a head coach is to develop your staff. And it's your responsibility to make sure whenever they get a head coaching job, they are ready. So even when I was at SUNY Canton, I had really young assistants. I had assistants it was their first job right out of college. I made sure that I would try to delegate as much as possible, whether that was breaking down film, whether that was doing scouts, whether that was running drills in practice, whether it was recruiting. I tried to give them responsibility. And now that I'm at Oberlin with the staff I just described, it's kind of taken to a new level where they're so good at what they do that for me, I can almost worry about kind of like I work with them on micro level stuff, but at the same time, like I can just focus on the big picture stuff. Like recruiting wise, like they have their states, I have my states. Like we just talk to recruits, and whenever they think like a recruit is close or like I should talk to them, like they'll tell me like, "Hey, coach, call this kid," and I'll go call that kid and kind of reiterate our interest. In terms of like practice, like Nate completely runs our offense. Like he essentially is our offensive coordinator, and Matt completely runs our defense. He's our defensive coordinator. And in the office, we talk about like kind of what, like schematically what we want to do. Everything's kind of in line to my beliefs of how I want to play. But at the same time, like when they're implementing stuff in practice, 90% of the time it's Nate and Matt implementing stuff. And then while we're doing drills, while we're playing, if I need to make a correction, if I need to coach guys, like that's what I'll do. But they're so good and they're so ready that at this point, they're almost like coordinators, and they're just worrying about their part of the plan, their part of their role. And it just allows me to kind of focus on the stuff that is really, really important.
All right. So if you're talking about big picture, let's take it sort of to present day. You finished this season, your first one together as a staff, your first year at Oberlin. What are you guys sitting down and talking about in the office? Obviously, there's a ton of things, but just maybe pick out one or two things that you guys talked about as the season ended of like, okay, here's what we did really well. Here's some areas where we need to improve. Just talk about kind of the end of season process for you guys as a staff.
Yeah. So absolutely. Really good question. So the first thing we did is we watched every single one of our games back. And The reason we did that is we wanted to get a really good feel of what we did well and what we didn't do well. And then from there, this is what we've been doing currently in the office, and we actually were just talking about this today. We're trying to figure out, based on the stuff we did well and didn't do well, how we want to play next year in terms. And for a lot of part things, it's going to be very similar. Like, I'm not a big believer in changing the big picture things up from year to year, but in terms of like actions, in terms of like what we're looking for, in terms of how we want to guard different stuff, like we, based on the guys we have returning, based on what we saw, we're really trying to work on what we can do. And what Matt's been really diving into is kind of our defensive side of the ball and kind of seeing like, hey, what stuff, what actions really gave us trouble? Why did it give us trouble? And Nate's been really diving in on the offensive side of the ball, saying like, hey, what were we really good at and why? And then from there, like, we've been kind of just looking at everything, having these like these discussions as a staff, saying like, hey, how do we want to play when it comes to October 15th next year? How do we want to play offensively and how do we want to play defensively? And these discussions we're going to continue doing throughout the summer. Like, our whole thing is, in Division III, I think in the offseason, there's two things that are really important you have to do in the office. You got to recruit and you got to prepare for next year. And those are the things we're really focusing on right now.
All right. So talk a little bit about the recruiting side of it. Obviously, you've got a lot of experience back in the Northeast and the New York area. You're coming to the Midwest, to maybe an area that you haven't recruited that heavily. Oberlin obviously draws from all over the country because of the academic institution that it is. So what's your process from sort of beginning to end when you first begin to identify players and then sort of narrow the funnel?
Yeah. So for right now, we're kind of in the midst of the early stages of that. We're going through all these different recruiting lists from different states to states. We're calling high school coaches. We're calling AAU programs. And we're trying to create our initial list. And based on that initial list, we're calling kids, introducing them to Oberlin, figuring out like at the surface level, if they're a good fit for that. And now as kind of the spring kind of goes forward, we're going to, at that point, start going to AAU tournaments, kind of see like where the most kids are, where we can get the best bang for our buck, where we get the best yield. And we're going to see as many recruits as possible in areas where we get a pretty good yield. And from there, we're going to kind of narrow our list. And by the time the summer comes, we're trying to get kids on campus for a visit for the first time. We're trying to get them to, we're going to show them campus. We're going to talk to them about our program and give them that initial visit over the summer. And from there, we're going to continue narrowing our list, figuring out who's a good fit for us, who we're a good fit for. And by the time we kind of get to the fall, that kind of list gets down to about 20, 25 kids that we're talking to, and we try to get them on overnight visits. And from the kids that come on overnight visits, we essentially tell them like, listen, like we don't, like I never put pressure on any kids to kind of commit. I think everyone needs to commit on their own timeline. But at the same time, we can only take certain amount of each position. Like it's not football. Like we can't take 25 kids. So like,
you don't have a 100 man roster.
Exactly. So like we're bringing in 5 kids this year, and those 5 kids all committed early position. And that's always like, so usually we're pretty much done recruiting in a given class by the middle of November. So that's kind of our timeline. But right now, what we're doing right now, is just kind of beginning talking to kids and building that initial list of kids that we think that could be good fits as we continue to get to know them.
All right. So once you have a kid on campus, you talked about a little earlier in terms of building relationships. What does that look like for you day to day, trying to build relationships with your kids on and off the court?
Yeah. So I was listening to the episode you had with Coach DeWitt. And one of the things I think he's an unbelievable coach. He's one of the best coaches that I've seen. And one of the things he talked about is he loves it when, like during the season, he hears music playing from the gym and he just goes down, he sits in the gym and he just talks with our guys. And for me, I think that's so invaluable. Like I'm not a big believer in having these formal meetings. Like I don't think kids feel comfortable enough to kind of speak their mind in these formal meetings. So what I try to do is I just try to be around them. Like I try to talk to them. I try to like talk about things outside of basketball. Like I know a lot of our guys love the NBA, love college hoops. I'll talk to them about different things they saw the night before. And what I try to do is I just try to build that trust. And I I let them know that they can come and talk to me about anything. I let them know right away that I'm always going to be honest with them, whether they like that, like what I'm saying or not. But just throughout talking to them, like just having conversations and building that trust, and just them knowing that I'm honest, we can get deeper and deeper into building a relationship. And I think it's pretty good now, where I think our guys feel pretty comfortable coming to me, talking to me. I think they have a really good relationship. But I also know, like, this is ever building. Like, if you're ever satisfied with that relationship you have with the kid, that's going to deteriorate. Like, it's a constant process. And my assistants and I, we always just try to talk to our guys as much as possible, be around them, and just letting them know that we're there for them in any way possible, whether it's on or off the court.
On the floor, when you start talking about putting together a plan for your season and breaking it down practice by practice, just what's your philosophy in terms of building a practice plan, and what do you like your practices to look and feel like?
Yeah, so for me, I don't want to ever spend 4 hours in a gym. Like, I just want to spend, like, I want to be really, really efficient. Like, I get at a place like Oberlin, our guys have a ton of schoolwork. They have a bunch of things going on. Like, part of the reason they went to Oberlin is so they can get this incredible experience in everything. So we try to be as efficient as possible. So for us, that means we're always going to kind of start off with kind of some form of dynamic warm up. Then we'll do some movement stuff, and that movement stuff will include skill workout, skill set stuff. So whether it's shooting, ball handling, passing, we'll always kind of get practice going like that. Then I'm really big on building defense. We break down defense from the ground up. So whether it's 1-on-1, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, or 5-on-5, we break it down and we work on different rotations. We work on guarding the ball, and we work on just competing and playing hard and through live action. And we do that every single day. And once we build the defense, now we work on offense. And for offense, a lot of it is 5-on-5 stuff, both half court and the full court. And we put our guys in different things, different spacing, different actions that we like to do in a game. And then we let them kind of play out at that. And one of the things I like to do is, especially when we're working on offense, I don't love kind of micro coaching. Like, I want guys to kind of play things out, figure things out. And then if I see something that needs to be changed, then I'll stop it, and then I'll coach them. But I want guys to get used to playing and competing. And in terms of kind of just the big picture, the biggest thing we're trying to get out of a practice, more than even defense or offense, is we want to teach our guys how to compete. We want to make sure our guys come out of every practice understanding what it's like to play hard, because that's the standard it takes to win a championship. And that this year, that's all we talked about, is the consistency of playing hard, the consistency of having a mindset. And in every single thing we do, we try to go live. In every single thing we do, we try to put a competitive aspect to it, so our guys get used to competing every single day.
When you're competing, how do you break down the groupings in practice and who plays with who? Do you go day by day? Do you go drill by drill? Just how do you make sure that guys who are, let's say, somebody who's the seventh or eighth man gets to play with the starters? Or are you balancing, hey, there's two starters on this group, two starters on that group? Just how do you break it down during practice?
Yeah, so it all depends on the time of year it is. So in the beginning of the season, before games start, we change up our teams in practice every single day. So every day in the locker room, we'll have a white team and a black team, the two colors of our practice uniforms. And we will, and that will come in before practice. And those teams are absolutely broken down, just based on different lineup combinations we want to see, different groups that we want to evaluate as a coaching staff. And we change that around all the time until game start. And then once game start, for the most part, like, our top 7 or 8 guys kind of play on one team, and then our top and then the rest of the guys kind of play on the other team, and they compete in everything. And then obviously, if we have a couple days before a game, we're like, say we don't play on a Saturday and we play on a Saturday and it's a Monday or Tuesday practice, we'll go back to having even teams so we can get the competition up in practice again. But then when we get back to like a Thursday practice or a Friday practice, when we're really working on the scout, working on game planning, we'll go back to like our top 8 or 9 on one team and then everyone else on the other team, so the top 8 or 9 can really get reps on what they're going to see in that game.
That makes sense. Are there things you track during practice?
Yeah. So we film our practice, and we stat your traditional stats, just like I'm sure every other coaching staff does. But on top of that, one of the unique things we love to do is we track rebounding. And for us, like I told you, like for me, everything is about the process. So it's not this we're tracking offensive and defensive rebound. We've broken it down to, hey, in every single, when the shot goes up, every single person on the defensive team has a responsibility, whether it's boxing out or going to go get the ball above the rim, depending on where you are, who you are. And then same thing, offensively, we have certain guys that we want to crash and we need them to get to certain spots on the floor. And every single possession, when we're watching it on film after practice in our office, we're tracking whether they execute that or not. And we put up in the, our goal is every single 5-on-5 possession of practice, we want to get, we track it, and we want to get 80% of 5-on-5 possessions where the defense does what they need to do rebounding wise and the offense does what they need to do rebounding wise. And if the more consistent, if we can get to a place where we're hitting 80% consistently, now we can be a really good rebounding team. And this year, like my teams at Canton, we would hit 80% consistently, and we were one of the best rebounding teams in the country. This year, we were kind of in the 70s, and we got a lot better rebounding compared to kind of where Oberlin was in the past. But still, I think we have room to grow, and it kind of, you can kind of see it in the process statistics why we're not one of the best rebounding teams in the country is because we never hit those 80% numbers on a consistent basis.
Is there something else you track? Is there a favorite metric you have during games, something that you found with your teams and the style of play that you have that translates to winning? Maybe there's multiple things that you kind of track during a game that you think, hey, these are really some key metrics that help us to win games.
Yeah. So we track a couple different things. On the defensive side, we track how many times we can get 3 stops in a row. I think the stat is like in a given game, if you can get 3 stops in a row 6 different times, that team wins 90% of games. So we try to track how many times we can get 3 stops in a row every single game. The other thing we try to do is offensively, we want to be a team that scores through assists. Like, we don't want to be this one-on-one dribble team. We want to be a team that moves the ball around. So we try to make sure that we're seeing what percentage of our field goals are coming from assists. And our goal is we want to have 60% of our field goals in a given game or more coming from assists, whether that's like making an assist for a layup, whether it's driving a kick 3-pointers or just making a one more pass in the perimeter. We want to get assists. So those are some things that we look for diving into like the more the analytics side of offensive and defensive basketball that we think can really help us produce wins on the floor.
When you went into this season, your first one there at Oberlin, and you thought about what a successful year would look like, and then you get to the end of the year and you have to evaluate that. Just talk about what you feel like were some areas that you had success in this first year and kind of that you're headed in the right direction moving forward.
Yeah. So what, like in terms of kind of just like our guys, like obviously we won 8 games and we got to continue to get better as a program. But the thing that makes me really excited for next year and the program as we move forward is how our guys reacted to kind of this, to the, when early in the season when we were really struggling. Like, to start league play, we start off 0-7. And I think it could have been really easy for our guys to kind of fold and kind of just say, like, hey, this season isn't for us, or this coach doesn't know what he's doing. It could have been any of that. But after this 0-7 league start, we turned around and we ended up going 500 in the last stretch of the league. And we ended up actually getting more wins in the previous season, more league wins, more regular season wins as well. And for me, what was the reason we were able to kind of get at least a little bit of a turnaround in that last stretch of the season was because our guys just stayed bought in and they never floundered in practice. They never had a bad attitude. They kind of, like, by that time they were kind of bought in, like, hey, this is a process. It's not going to be easy. We're going to continue working. And for me, that was a critical moment where when I knew we're not going to lose our guys, when I knew, like, hey, every single day we would show up to practice and guys would have a good attitude and guys were competing and guys were playing as hard as they can and they were being great teammates, I knew that we had the right type of kids to be successful. And I was just really happy for them that eventually we got to a place where now we started beating some teams and we beat Worcester for the first time in 45 years. and we had some like key moments, made the NCAA tournament for the first time in a couple years, and they ended up achieving some key goals we had in the beginning of the season, but it took longer than expected, and they never faltered and they never wavered in their belief. And for me, that was something that that made me really excited for just the growth of this program.
It's sometimes easy to sell that in the fall, right? Before you start playing games. It's a lot harder to sell after you've lost some games to get guys to continue to buy in. So the fact that you were able to kind of get through that rough patch and get through the dip and then come through it on the other side and feel like you were stronger and had some success like you did, I think that speaks well of what you were able to do and where you're headed.
Yeah, and it's all, and just to kind of like, it's a lot with the guys. Like, it's just, we have guys that honestly, they're like, I talked about resiliency, and like, obviously you can't like in 1 year, like make an entire program resilient. But one of the things like I think I'm really fortunate for, and there's so many things that have confirmed to me, like, hey, I'm in a really good spot. Like, I'm really enjoying Oberlin. But this is one of those things where like, we just got lucky where we coach this incredibly resilient bunch of kids. And I don't know if like most people would expect that coming from Oberlin, coming from this like elite academic institution, but we just have kids that are tough and kids that are resilient. I think that's where like, I think it's like, obviously we talk about the mentality every single day in practice, but it's also the credit of the guys. Like, the guys are really, really tough.
I think that when you have the right guys, and clearly as you start the process and you inherited some guys and now you're in the process of recruiting and getting guys that fit what you're looking for, and as you get the right guys into your program and you continue to build with the guys that you have, then that's where you're going to turn around and be able to have success and continue to win games and continue to build the program. As we head towards an hour and a half, I want to ask you one final two-part question, Shiva. First part is, when you look ahead, so here you are sitting here today on April the 6th, what's your biggest challenge over the next year or two, do you think? And then number two, when you think about what you get to do every day, what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Yeah. So I think the biggest challenge at Oberlin is the fact that there isn't this history of success, especially in a league where there's so much success around it. Like at Wittenberg and Worcester, the two winningest programs in NCAA history. Wabash has won national titles. Ohio Wesleyan has won national titles. So in a league where there's so many successful programs, being a program that hasn't experienced that success, I think can be challenging. And I think it hurts us a little bit. Like, we don't get a ton of Ohio guys. And part of the reason I think so is like, we're just not a name brand compared to like the Wittenbergs of the world, that kids, like, even though a small college, like, kids have heard of Wittenberg, kids have heard of Worcester. And that's a conception that we're trying to fight every single day. And like, I think being able to recruit Ohio is going to be important for us as we move forward. So I think that's a challenge. And I think as we get better and better, and as we continue to move up the league rankings, I think that's going to be something that is going to hopefully solve itself. And I think building the program is really important in that. Now, the biggest joy for me is I genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, hope that we kind of achieve our goals and continue growing for this program. And it's not necessarily for me or even the coaching staff. It's because, like I said, we have such good kids here. We have such good, like, we have kids that really care. They cared before I even got here. Like I told you, with the things they planned, like the off-season stuff that they planned on their own. Like, we have such good kids, and we have kids that want it really bad. And like, they're completely bought in on the process. And I hope that it's going to translate to on-course success, because I want them to know that, hey, if you worry about things you can control, if you can worry about the process, if you approach things the right way, you're going to be successful. And I want them to see that, and I want them to experience that, because I know these kids really want that, and they're great kids. And for me, like, when we can get to a point where we're competing at the top of our league, when we get to a point where we're hopefully kind of, we can beat anyone in the NCAC, go and play in the NCAA tournament, then that's a moment that I hope we can get to, and I really look forward to, because I'm going to love what that means for every single thing our players have gone through and every single thing our players stand for.
That's awesome. It's good stuff. And I think that as you start looking ahead and you think about what you can do, what you want to do, and what Oberlin has the potential to be able to do, I think it was well said. And I think you clearly laid out the groundwork for what that's going to look like as we go forward. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can find out more about you, about your program. You want to share social media, website, email, whatever you feel comfortable with, and how people can reach out to you. And then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah. So first of all, I appreciate your time. This has been awesome. I appreciate everything you're doing for kind of the basketball community. I'm a fan myself, and it was an honor kind of getting on. For everyone that wants to reach out to me, the easiest way is through email. It's SSENTHI1@oberlin.edu. Or you can reach me on social media. My Twitter is coach_Senthil, SENTHIL, which is my last name. So you can reach me on Twitter. You can reach me on through email. Any way you can, just if you reach out, I'll respond. But yeah, once again, thank you. And I appreciate your time, Mike.
Absolutely. Shiva, can I thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us tonight? Truly appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.